Welcome to the Java.net Community Corner podcast series for Java 1 2008. In this series of podcasts, we bring you the activity of the Community Corner, located at booth 101 on the Java 1 Pavilion floor, including mini-talks about projects hosted on Java.net and other community activities. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Java.net Community Corner. It is noon, and it's time for our next mini-talk, and we've got Michael Culling and Devin talking about BlueJay. Take it away, Michael.
Thank you very much. Welcome, and we are going to talk a bit about BlueJay. For this presentation, we assume that you don't know very much about BlueJay at all at the moment, so we start at the beginning. And halfway through, we can maybe see where there are some specific questions and then decide what we spend the second half of our time on talking about. So first, as an introduction, BlueJay is an educational development environment. That is, it's a Java development environment that is specifically designed with beginning programmers in mind. Users or designers of other environments, professional development environments such as NetBeans and Eclipse and so, occasionally claim that you can also use it in education. But actually, the requirements, design requirements for an environment for education are quite different from requirements for environments for professional developers. For professional developers, you usually want a large number of tools, a lot of flexibility, support for a lot of things, whereas for an educational environment, the flexibility very quickly turns into complexity that gets in the way rather than helping the solutions. So the requirements are quite different. One of the important requirements is simplicity, and we have BlueJay up on the screen here, and you can see immediately there is not very much on the screen. The initial interface is very simple. There's not a great deal there, and in fact, we get students very quickly within a week or so to a point where they know the whole environment. They really know everything there is. You know, in things like NetBeans and Eclipse or Visual Studio or what have you, they even at the end of the whole year, they do not reach that point. You know, so there always remains a certain amount of doubt and insecurity where even if they manage to do something, they never really know, is there a better way of doing this? You know, what are all these other menu options? Should I maybe have done something different? They do not reach a level of feeling comfortable with the environment. With BlueJay, we essentially don't talk about the environment at all. In the first lecture they get, usually we do a live demo, and then we never talk about it again. We really can concentrate on talking about programming principles and concepts, and the environment fades into the background and essentially disappears. So we'll give you a quick demo now of the environment. Here, what you see on screen is the BlueJay environment, and we have a project open here. And you notice that the first thing you see on screen is a class diagram. So that's a UML-like diagram. So you see immediately what classes are involved in this project. That is sort of the main part of the screen. These classes here have already been implemented, so there is some source code there. And of course, it's an IDE like all IDEs. It has an editor. And you can just, Devin, can you just open an editor? And you see, I don't want to talk much about the editor because it's just a standard editor. You all know what that is. There's nothing really special about that. So close that again, because with students, that is not the first thing we look at. What we typically do is that we start off by instantiating objects, and that's one of the unique things about BlueJay. You can interactively instantiate objects. So if I have a few classes here, I can click on the class, and what Devin is just showing you here is that you get a menu up associated with a class, and you can now interactively call the constructor of the class. And we see here that the class student that Devin is using here has two constructors. One is a default constructor without parameters, and one has parameters. Just instantiate the student with the parameters. Let's just go through the exercise of actually typing something in. If you interactively invoke an object or invoke a method that expects parameters, you get a dialog that lets you interactively supply values for the parameters now. So here we need a name for the student. Call him something. Okay, so that's Tim, a year of birth. So here we fill in the parameters, and then when we've done that, we can, on the fly, create an object of this class. And the objects that we are creating, they become visible here at the bottom of the screen on the object bench, and then we can go and interact with these objects directly. Now, if we click on that object, we can see all the public methods of the object. Oh, that was a double click.
I'm not used to this thing.
I've got my trackpad configured differently from Devin. If you tap on it in the right way, it's actually a double click. So here we see that we have the public methods of the object in a menu. In fact, there are two public methods implemented here in the student class directly. And there's also, we can access the inherited public methods. We can see in the class diagram here that we've got inheritance. So if we look at the submenu for person, then we see also the public methods of the superclasses are available. And now let's invoke a method first that is an accessor method. Let's do the getStudentID, for example. If you invoke a method that has a result, it is just shown in the dialog. And if you invoke a method that expects a parameter, say use setName from person, if we made a mistake with the name and we want to change the name, we can do that interactively now and change the name. Of course, educationally, it's really important then to not only create one object, but create multiple objects. Just create another student, and you can now use the default constructor because now the values will just have default values, but I don't care. And already at this stage, if you do that with students, we have done a number of really important things. First of all, we can here talk about important object-oriented programming principles rather than talking about where the semicolons go. In traditional environments, the first thing you have to talk students through is public, static, void, main, bracket, strings, semicolon, blah, blah, blah. This whole public, static, void, main line in itself is a major problem because that one line alone contains six major concepts, all of which you do not want to explain. Now, it has access modifiers, it has return types, it has arrays, it has parameters, and none of that is relevant at that point. So you either try to explain it all and you get stuck in the mud and you get to execute a program 3 weeks later, or you do this hand-waving thing and say, well, just type that in and don't worry about it now, which is not ideal either because it sends the message to the students that programming is something that you can't understand. So we don't have to do this. First, before we look at the syntax, we discuss the concepts. Here we already see things like an application is a set of cooperating classes. There are classes involved and they somehow relate to each other. From a class, you can create objects. You can communicate with objects by invoking the methods. Methods may have parameters. Methods may have return values. We can also talk about state. So if you double-click the object again, we can actually open up the object and look inside it. And you see here, this student object has three fields. And I can see there are three fields. And this is the one we constructed with the default constructor, so there are default values in there now. And if you move that to the side and leave it open, and we can see that the name at the moment just says unknown name, and now we can go to that student object, that student 2. No, that's... Oh, yeah.
Student that, 1, yeah.
That's another interesting thing to show. You can then compare the state of the two objects, and you see things like they have the same number of fields, they have the same kind of fields, but the actual value for each field is specific to each object. Those are important concepts. Those are important things to understand. And now we can also just invoke a method. If you want to now fix the name here in this student, we can do this. Leave that open and then invoke the setName method. And we can really get across concepts such as if you want to change the state of an object, the way you do that is you invoke a method that asks the object to change its state. And if you now watch this field as we invoke this method, you see that this is updated in real time and you see how the field changes when you execute the method. So here we get all the important principles of object orientation across before we have to get stuck into the syntax. And of course, syntax you have to master at some stage and this is typically the first hour, the first lecture they get. We discuss object orientation at this level, and then from the second day on already we then open it up and look at syntax and look how it is implemented. But all the discussion of syntax happens in the context of object-oriented concepts. So when we actually start looking at code and modifying code, we're doing it in the context of we are now changing the behavior of an object. And they know what an object is, they know what behavior is, they know what a method is, and we are then talking about, how do we now write down really what should happen. We don't start at first with, here's a bracket, here's a semicolon, and then 3 months later we arrive at the point where we say, and now we look at objects. That is, in our opinion, very much the wrong way around. But the Java with its syntax environments, with standard environments, forces that sequence on you. And Blue.js environment allows you to switch that around and look at the object-oriented concepts first. And what you also see is you actually see objects. You can interact with objects. You can see them. You can touch them. In other environments where we actually need students to have an understanding of objects and think in terms of objects, what we actually show them on screen is just lines of code. Now, if you look at Visual Studio, if you look at NetBeans, what you see on the screen is mostly lines of code. So what we want them to think about is classes and objects. And what they interact with in the environment is files and lines of code. There is a conceptual mismatch there. There are no objects in the environment. Now, so from an educational perspective, if that is what we want them to think about, that's what we want to show them. Professional environments work well if you already have the concepts in your head and you can do that on your own in your head. You have the model in your head about how your object interactions work. But you really have to know that already to effectively work with this. The environment gives you no support for learning this. We have here the diagram gets automatically generated. So if we close the inspector windows again, if we just look at interaction, just open the student class and move that a bit to the side, the editor window. If you now remove the extends person from the class and save this, and then when we compile this immediately, of course, this doesn't compile now, but the diagram you see is updated live. So here this arrow just disappeared. It has now realized that in the text the inheritance relationship is not there anymore. And it works the other way around as well. If you now grab in the main window the extends arrow and put that in again, we can graphically edit this and say that's a subclass. It puts the text here in again in the editor. So the text and the diagram are two representations of the same relationship, and they are kept in sync at all times. So you can work at the overview level or at the textual level in different parts of your workflow. So this interaction with the objects is one of the most important features of Blue.js that really educational is very, very powerful. We have three overall guiding principles that have designed the design of Blue.js very fundamentally. One is simplicity. I mentioned that at the beginning. We want a very simple interface. There's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes, but on the surface, Blue.js is very, very simple. We don't have these 200 menu items. You know, there's very few functions visible initially to the students, and it's very unintimidating. So simplicity was one. Visualization was the second. You see that we show the objects, we show the classes, and the third one is interaction. We want students to actually become active and experiment, and the object bench is one of the ways to do this. So these are the most fundamental principles. And now we can talk about some of the other tools that we have in Blue.js. We have in Blue.js support for debugging. We have support for group work. We have support for automated testing. I cannot show all of them today. Is there a special area that you're particularly interested in? Debugging? Okay, let's look at debugging. We have a debugger in Blue.js, and as all the tools in Blue.js, they are in principle very similar to the professional tools, but simpler. So debugging in Blue.js, usually we start by setting breakpoints. So let's say we want to see how the super call here in a constructor works. Let's say I'm an instructor. I just want to explain at the moment how initialization with inheritance works, you know, the call of the superclass constructor. I can set a breakpoint here just by clicking next to the line in the editor. So I have a breakpoint. And then when we execute this now, we should fall into the debugger. So here, now as soon as we have just interactively invoked this constructor now, as soon as we hit this point, this line gets marked. There's an arrow here. There is a comment here that says that we have stopped at a breakpoint, and a debugger window comes up. The debugger in Blue.js really does only three things. We do breakpoints, we do single stepping, and we do display of variables. And you don't need any commands to to actually look at the variables. We just constantly display the values of all variables in scope. So here are the instance variables, and then static and local, here are the areas. We don't have any of those right now. But we can see here that we've got three instance variables, and they are all set to their default values at the moment. And now what we can do, we can either step over or step into this. Let's step into this for now. And then we see now we are in the here in the constructor of the superclass. That window's slightly outside the display screen here. Okay, so we can see it better. And we can see now that we are here. And now we can single step through it. And as we do it, by just clicking the step button here, we can watch here the variables. And we can see that now this has changed from null to this unknown name string. And if you make that window a little larger, then you can see that a bit better. And so we can now watch initialization of variables. We could watch control flow. If we are, for example, discussing loops, we can step through the loop and watch the loop counter. And so if we step on, we can see here when we come out of the superclass constructor, now we are back here again. And we can see also in the display of the debugger window that now these two variables, the year and the name, are already initialized, and the student ID, SID here, is still null. And then here, we expect the next statement now to be the assignment to the SID. And we can see that happening over here. We can see that. So this is already the full complexity of the debugger. You know, so the debugger, as are the other Blue Data tools, is of a complexity that it takes me about 5 minutes to show them how to start using it. But the whole user interface are these five buttons. You know, so there is no great complexity there. Students don't have to sit down for 2 hours and study documentation to use a new tool. It's a 5-minute introduction, but it does exactly those things that are really valuable for teaching. Professional debuggers can do a lot more, so we do only a subset of the functionality, but in return, what we get for this is we get a very, very simple user interface. So we work at universities, Devin and I both do, and this is driven essentially by pedagogical requirements. So when we designed this, what we sit down and think about, you know, what are the tools that we really need for students to understand what's going on? And here, the learning goals are twofold. We want them to understand the principles of a debugger, and we want them to use the debugger to understand the principles of programming. So we want to be able to explain control flow and all those things. And then the goal is to come up with the simplest interface we can to support those functions we really want and strip out everything else. And that is the general principle of BlueJay. We support the things that are important as well as we can and leave out everything else. And that leaving out everything else buys us a whole lot of benefits that we get out of it. We have a very narrow target group. BlueJay is designed for introductory learners for the first year, and that's it. We do not believe that you should use BlueJay in earnest after a year or so. There is, just as much as we believe that it is a good thing to start learning with BlueJay, we also believe you have to move out of it at some stage. Now, knowing BlueJay in itself is not a goal in itself. It's a stepping stone. It's a tool for learning something different. And then by the time they graduate from our departments, they should, of course, be proficient in a professional environment. So that is a goal at a later stage. So leaving BlueJay is just as important. And by having this very narrow target group to looking only at first-year learning of programming, we are not trying to do everything, but the small slice that we're trying to do, we actually can do better than other environments because we don't have to make compromises. In other professional environments, you always have competing forces because you have some more competent programmers who want more tools, who want to do more complicated things, and necessarily, because of those pressures, they have to make compromises, they have to find the middle ground. By having this very narrow target group, we don't have to do this, and we can do this one small slice of the market better than other environments can. We have a few minutes left, so... Oh, there's a question.
So I saw the Greenfoot talk, And I'm wondering if you had a high school student who'd been doing, who's an expert at Greenfoot, they'd been doing it for a couple of years, and they were ready for Blue Jay. Could you talk a little about how you do that transition?
I can talk about it, but I can talk about it mostly as speculation, because Greenfoot is so young that we actually are not at that point yet. We have no Greenfoot users that have a couple of years' experience. We are only now hitting the first generation of learners coming out of Greenfoot. And so the transition, we have no real data for yet. So I'll have to defer that question really to the next year, because we have just had the first generation coming through Greenfoot and now getting transferred into Blue Jay. We have ideas how you should be doing it, but only speculation how well it actually works. So I can't give real data on this. But you can see, if you have seen Greenfoot and you have seen Blue Jay, some of the things you realize then is there are similarities. The classes, even though the diagrams look different, there are clear visual similarities, so that the concepts carry across very easily. The interaction style with the classes and objects is very similar. There is quite intentionally a lot of visual and interaction similarity between Greenfoot and Blue Jay, so that the concepts that learners learn in Greenfoot as a first environment at school level then carry across very easily to Blue Jay. That is the design goal, that's the hope, and as I say, the data, we have to wait for a year until we see whether that really works. Maybe as one last thing, we show you a little bit of test automation, unit testing. We have support for unit testing here. We have already shown that you can do ad hoc testing very, very easily. That is the interactive testing. That works really well. It is a very good learning tool, and also it means that you can get very quick feedback, very quick turnaround. You don't have to write a complete application to be able to test it. As soon as you have implemented a single method, you can immediately execute and see whether it works. You know, you write three lines of code and you try them out. You know, that's one thing that in Java with other environments is not that easy. You have to always have at least one class with the main method syntactically correct before you can do anything else. So that is good for ad hoc testing, but it is, of course, not very good for regression testing, for repeating the tests. And so we have support for JUnit. Let's just now create a JUnit class. We have, in fact, better support for JUnit than most other environments because we have a combination with the interactive testing that Blue Jay does so well.
What should we test? Student or...?
Yeah, test student. It doesn't really matter very much.
Okay.
We have here an option to create a test class. Blue Jay will automatically create this class, and it will associate it with the class being tested. So if now, Devon, if you drag the student class around a bit, that association is visually maintained, so that is always associated with this class. And in fact, we have already generated a skeleton of the class that this is a valid JUnit class. If we look at this, there is a syntactically valid JUnit class. It has the setup and teardown methods that are prescribed by JUnit, but they are empty. Of course, there's no test code in there, but it compiles. So we always have a state that compiles. And now we can create tests by doing interactive testing and just recording it. You know, so we don't have to write our JUnit tests by hand. So start recording a test. And let's say we want to ensure that, say, the name gets initialized properly when we create an object. So we call it test name. So we have here, we're now starting to record a test, and you notice over here the recording light is now on. Everything we do now gets recorded as a JUnit test. So the test, let's create an object with the constructor where we actually specify the parameters. And if we head one further, there's a drop-down menu actually. You can, if you click on this, you can just recall previously used parameter values just to speed up your input a bit. So we're creating here a student with name Ruby and create the object. And then we call the getName method to check whether the name is actually what we expect. That should test whether it has been initialized properly as we expect. So we call the getName method. And now when we're in test recording mode, we not only see the result, we also get the ability to attach an assertion to this. And so entirely independent of whether the result is correct or not at this stage, we can specify what we expect to come out of it. And in this case, it happens to be correct. So we attach this assertion and close this, and that is our first test complete. So we can end the test recording. And at that time, the unit test gets written, and it gets written in standard unit test form. So this is, there's nothing special here. This is a standard unit test class, and we can, in fact, also write that by hand. And we can go now and edit these tests by hand as well. So you can, without any problem, mix manual test writing and the recording. And the last thing we should show you is now actually running this test. We have different levels. The easiest is here, the Run Tests button over on the left. That just runs all the tests that we've got in the project. At this stage, we have only one. And you get this fairly standard-looking JUnit output. You know the green bar, everything's fine. Go for the green and what they say. And a list of the tests here, which one have succeeded or failed. We can do a little more than standard JUnit tools because we can also run tests individually. So if we go to the test class directly, I have the option here to run all the tests of this class, which runs the test only of this class, or individual test methods. You know, so I can test at every level I want to. And that is a very nice combination of this interactive testing and regression testing, where we can do our interactive testing, but then record it as JUnit tests. And you can even do test first, because you can just write method stubs and then interactively record all your tests, even though the implementations don't exist, because you can just specify what you want to come out of it. We're out of time, so I think, do we have time for a question, or shall we just take that offline? Okay, then thank you very much for coming.
All right, thank you very much. Michael Colling and Devin McCall with BlueJay. And coming up very shortly at 12:30, we have Kevin Nilsson on Comet and Bayo. This has been the Java.net Community Corner Podcast. Check out more mini talks from Java 1 2008 at today.java.net/pub/ct/Java 1 Community Corner, or subscribe to our feed with iTunes.